He could deal with that, he thought, though not as easily in this small town as in New York or Berlin. And tomorrow was Saturday, so the Frunzes would probably spend the day together. How long might Volodya have to wait before catching Frunze alone? There was never an easy way to do this. On balance, he decided to go ahead tonight. The Frunzes went into a diner. Volodya walked past the place and glanced through the window. It was an inexpensive restaurant with booths. He thought of going in and sitting down with them, but he decided to let them eat first. They would be in a good mood when full of food. He waited half an hour, watching the door from a distance. Then, full of trepidation, he went in. They were finishing their dinner. As he crossed the restaurant, Frunze glanced up, then looked away, not recognizing him. He slid into the booth next to Alice and spoke quietly in German.
"Hello, Willy. Don't you remember me from school?"
Frunze looked hard at him for several seconds. Then his face broke into a smile.
"Peshkov! Volodya Peshkov! Is it really you?"
A wave of relief washed over Volodya. Frunze was still friendly. There was no barrier of hostility to overcome.
"It's really me," Volodya said.
He offered his hand and they shook. Turning to Alice, he said in English,
"I am very bad speaking your language. Sorry."
"Don't bother to try," she replied in fluent German. "My family were immigrants from Bavaria." Frunze said in amazement,
"I've been thinking about you lately because I know another guy with the same surname, Greg Peshkov."
"Really? My father had a brother called Lev who came to America in about 1915.
"No, Lieutenant Peshkov is much younger. Anyway, what are you doing here?"
Volodya smiled.
"I came to see you."
Before Frunze could ask why, he said, "Last time I saw you, you were secretary of the Neukölln Social Democratic Party." This was his second step. Having established a friendly footing, he was reminding Frunze of his youthful idealism.
"That experience convinced me that democratic socialism doesn't work," Frunze said. "Against the Nazis, we were completely impotent. It took the Soviet Union to stop them."
That was true, and Volodya was pleased Frunze realized it. But, more importantly, the comment showed that Frunze's political ideas had not been softened by life in affluent America. Alice said,
"We were planning to have a couple of drinks at a bar around the corner. A lot of the scientists go there on a Friday night. Would you like to join us?"
The last thing Volodya wanted was to be seen in public with the Frunzes.
"I don't know," he said.
In fact, he had been too long with them in this restaurant. It was time for step three, reminding Frunze of his terrible guilt. He leaned forward and lowered his voice.
"Willy, did you know the Americans were going to drop nuclear bombs on Japan?"
There was a long pause. Volodya held his breath. He was gambling that Frunze would be racked by remorse. For a moment he feared he had gone too far. Frunze looked as if he might burst into tears. Then the scientist took a deep breath and got control of himself.
"No, I didn't know," he said. "None of us did."
Alice interjected angrily, "We assumed the American military would give some demonstration of the power of the bomb, as a threat, to make the Japanese surrender earlier." So she had known about the bomb beforehand, Volodya noted. He was not surprised. Men found it hard to keep such things from their wives. "So we expected a detonation sometime, somewhere," she went on, "but we imagined they would destroy an uninhabited island, or maybe a military facility with a lot of weapons and very few people."
"That might have been justifiable," Frunze said. "But,"
his voice fell to a whisper,
"nobody thought they would drop it on a city and kill 80,000 men, women, and children."
Volodya nodded.
"I thought you might feel this way."
He had been hoping for it with all his heart. Frunze said,
"Who wouldn't?" "Let me ask you an even more important question."
This was step four.
"Will they do it again?"
"I don't know," Frunze said. "They might. Christ forgive us all. They might."
Volodya concealed his satisfaction. He had made Frunze feel responsible for future use of nuclear weapons, as well as past. Volodya nodded.
"That's what we think."
Alice said sharply,
"Who's we?"
She was shrewd, and probably more worldly wise than her husband. She would be hard to fool, and Volodya decided not to try. He had to risk leveling with her.
A fair question, he said, and I didn't come all this way to deceive an old friend. I'm a major in Red Army intelligence. They stared at him. The possibility must have crossed their minds already, but they were surprised by the stark admission. I have something I need to say to you, Volodya went on, something hugely important. Is there somewhere we can go to talk privately? They both looked uncertain. Franza said, Our apartment? It has probably been bugged by the FBI. Franza had some experience of clandestine work, but Alice was shocked. You think so? She said incredulously. Yes. Could we drive out of town? Franza said, There's a place we go sometimes, around this time of the evening, to watch the sunset. Perfect. Go to your car, sit in, and wait for me. I'll be a minute behind you. Franza paid the check and left with Alice, and Volodya followed. During the short walk he established that no one was tailing him. He reached the Plymouth and got in. They sat three across the front seat, American style. Franza drove out of town. They followed a dirt road to the top of a low hill. Franza stopped the car. Volodya motioned for them all to get out, and led them 100 yards away, just in case the car was bugged too. They looked across the landscape of stony soil and low bushes toward the setting sun, and Volodya took step 5. We think the next nuclear bomb will be dropped somewhere in the Soviet Union. Franza nodded. God forbid, but you're probably right. And there's absolutely nothing we can do about it, Volodya went on, pressing home his point relentlessly. There are no precautions we can take, no barriers we can erect, no way we can protect our people. There is no defense against the nuclear bomb, the bomb that you made, Willie. I know it, said Franza miserably. Clearly he felt it would be his fault if the USSR was attacked with nuclear weapons. Step 6. The only protection would be our own nuclear bomb. Franza did not want to believe that. It's not a defense, he said. But it's a deterrent. It might be, he conceded. Alice said, We don't want these bombs to spread. Nor do I, said Volodya. But the only sure way to stop the Americans flattening Moscow, the way they flattened Hiroshima, is for the Soviet Union to have a nuclear bomb of its own, and threaten retaliation. Alice said, He's right, Willie. Hell, we all know it. She was the tough one, Volodya saw. Volodya made his voice light for step 7. How many bombs do the Americans have right now? This was a crucial moment. If Franza answered this question, he would have crossed a line. So far the conversation had been general. Now Volodya was requesting secret information. Franza hesitated for a long moment. Finally he glanced at Alice. Volodya saw her give an almost imperceptible nod. Franza said, Only one. Volodya concealed his triumph. Franza had betrayed trust. It was the difficult first move. A second secret would come more easily. Franza added, But they'll have more soon. It's a race, and if we lose, we die, Volodya said urgently. We have to build at least one bomb of our own before they have enough to wipe us out. Can you do that? That gave Volodya the cue for step 8. We need help. He saw Frunze's face harden, and guessed he was remembering whatever it was that had made him refuse to cooperate with the NKVD. Alice said to Volodya, What if we say we can't help you? That it's too dangerous? Volodya followed his instinct. He held up his hands in a gesture of surrender. I go home and report failure, he said. I can't make you do anything you don't want to do. I wouldn't want to pressure you or coerce you in any way. Alice said, No threats? That confirmed Volodya's guess that the NKVD had tried to bully Franza. They tried to bully everyone. It was all they knew. I'm not even trying to persuade you, Volodya said to Franza. I'm laying out the facts. The rest is up to you. If you want to help, I'm here as your contact. If you see things differently, that's the end of it. You're both smart people. I couldn't fool you even if I wanted to. Again they looked at each other. He hoped they were thinking how different he was from the last Soviet agent who had approached them. The moment stretched out agonizingly. It was Alice who spoke at last. What kind of help do you need? That was not a yes,
But it was better than rejection, and it led logically to step 9.
My wife is one of the physicists on the team, he said, hoping this would humanize him at a moment when they might be in danger of seeing him as manipulative. She tells me there are several routes to a nuclear bomb, and we don't have time to try them all. We can save years if we know what worked for you.
That makes sense, Willy said. Step 10, the big one. We have to know what type of bomb was dropped on Japan.
Franz's expression was agonized. He looked at his wife. This time she did not give him the nod, but neither did she shake her head. She seemed as torn as he did.
Franz sighed.
Two kinds, he said.
Volodya was thrilled and startled.
Two different designs?
Franz nodded. For Hiroshima, they used a uranium device with a gun ignition. They called it Little Boy. For Nagasaki, Fat Man, a plutonium bomb with an implosion trigger.
Volodya could hardly breathe. This was red-hot data.
Which is better?
They both worked, obviously, but Fat Man is easier to make.
Why?
It takes years to produce enough U-235 for a bomb. Plutonium is quicker, once you have a nuclear pile.
So the USSR should copy Fat Man.
Definitely.
There is one more thing you could do to help save Russia from destruction,
Volodya said.
But?
Volodya looked him in the eye.
Get me the design drawings, he said.
Willy paled.
I'm an American citizen, he said. You're asking me to commit treason. The penalty is death. I could go to the electric chair.
So could your wife,
Volodya thought. She's complicit.
Thank God you haven't thought of that.
He said, I've asked a lot of people to put their lives at risk in the last few years.
People like yourselves. Germans who hated the Nazis. Men and women who took terrible risks to send us information that helped us win the war. And I have to say to you what I said to them. A lot more people will be killed if you don't do it.
He fell silent. That was his best shot. He had nothing more to offer.
Franz looked at his wife.
Alice said, You made the bomb, Willy?
Franz said to Volodya,
I'll think about it.
3. 2 days later, he handed over the plans. Volodya took them to Moscow. Zoya was released from jail. She was not as angry about her imprisonment as he was.
They did it to protect the revolution, she said, and I wasn't hurt. It was like staying in a really bad hotel.
On her first day at home, after they made love, he said, I have something to show you, something I brought back from America. He rolled off the bed, opened a drawer, and took out a book. It's called the Sears Roebuck Catalog, he said. He sat beside her on the bed and opened the book.
Look at this.
The catalog fell open at a page of women's dresses. The models were impossibly slender, but the fabrics were bright and cheerful, stripes and checks and solid colors, some with ruffles, pleats, and belts.
That's attractive,
Zoya said, putting her finger on one.
Is $2.98 a lot of money?
Not really, Volodya said. The average wage is about $50 a week. Rent is about a third of it.
Really?
Zoya was amazed. So most people could easily afford these dresses.
That's right. Maybe not peasants. On the other hand, these catalogs were invented for farmers who lived 100 miles from the nearest store.
How does it work?
You pick what you want from the book and send them the money. Then a couple of weeks later, the mailman brings you whatever you ordered.
It must be like being a tsar.
Zoya took the book from him and turned the page.
Oh, here are some more.
The next page showed jacket and skirt combinations for $4.98.
These are elegant too, she said.
Keep turning the pages, Volodya said.
Zoya was astonished to see page after page of women's coats, hats, shoes, underwear, pajamas, and stockings.
People can have any of these, she said.
That's right.
But there's more choice on one of these pages than there is in the average Russian shop.
Yes.
She carried on slowly leafing through the book. There was a similar range of clothing for men, and again for children. Zoya put her finger on a heavy woolen winter coat for boys that cost $15.
At that price, I suppose every boy in America has one. They probably do.
After the clothes came furniture. You could buy a bed for $25. Everything was cheap, if you had $50 a week, and it went on and on. There were hundreds of things that could not be bought for any money in the Soviet Union. Toys and games, beauty products, guitars, elegant chairs, power tools, novels in colorful jackets, Christmas decorations and electric toasters. There was even a tractor.
"Do you think," Zoya said, "that any farmer in America who wants a tractor can have one right away?"
"Only if he has the money," said Volodya.
"He doesn't have to put his name down on a list and wait for a few years?"
"No."
Zoya closed the book and looked at him solemnly.
"If people can have all this," she said, "why would they want to be communist?"
"Good question," said Volodya.
Chapter 22 1946 The children of Berlin had a new game called Komm, Frau. Come, woman. It was one of a dozen games in which boys chased girls. But it had a new twist, Carla noticed. The boys would team up and target one of the girls. When they caught her, they would shout, "Komm, Frau!" and throw her to the ground. Then they would hold her down while one of their number lay on top of her and simulated sexual intercourse. Children of 7 and 8, who ought not to know what rape was, played this game because they had seen what Red Army soldiers did to German women. Every Russian knew that one phrase of the German language, "Komm, Frau." What was it about the Russians? Carla had never met anyone who had been raped by a French, British, American, or Canadian soldier, though she supposed it must happen. By contrast, every woman she knew between 15 and 55 had been raped by at least one Soviet soldier. Her mother Maud, her friend Frida, Frida's mother Monica, Ada the maid. All of them. Yet they were lucky, for they were still alive. Some women, abused by dozens of men, hour after hour, had died. Carla had heard of a girl who had been bitten to death. Only Rebecca Rosen had escaped. After Carla had protected her, the day the Jewish hospital was liberated, Rebecca moved into the von Ulrich townhouse. It was in the Soviet zone, but she had nowhere else to go. She hid for months like a criminal in the attic, coming down only late at night when the bestial Russians had fallen into drunken sleep. Carla spent a couple of hours up there with her when she could, and they played card games and told each other their life stories. Carla wanted to be like an older sister, but Rebecca treated her like a mother. Then Carla found she was going to be a mother for real. Maud and Monica were in their 50s, and too old to have babies, mercifully, and Ada was lucky. But both Carla and Frida were pregnant by their rapists. Frida had an abortion. It was illegal, and a Nazi law that threatened the death penalty was still in force. So Frida went to an elderly midwife, who did it for 5 cigarettes. Frida contracted a severe infection and would have died, but that Carla was able to steal scarce penicillin from the hospital. Carla decided to have her baby. Her feelings about it swung violently from one extreme to another. When suffering morning sickness, she raged against the beasts who had violated her body and left her with this burden. At other times, she found herself sitting with her hands on her belly, staring into space, and thinking dreamily about baby clothes. Then she would wonder if the baby's face would remind her of one of the men and cause her to hate her own child. But surely it would have some von Ulrich features, too. She felt anxious and frightened. She was 8 months pregnant in January 1946. Like most Germans, she was also cold, hungry, and destitute. When her pregnancy became obvious, she had to give up nursing and join the millions of unemployed. Food rations were issued every 10 days. The daily amount, for those without special privileges, was 1,500 calories. It still had to be paid for, of course. And even for customers with cash and ration cards, sometimes there was simply no food to buy. Carla had considered asking the Soviets for special treatment because of her wartime work as a spy. But Heinrich had tried that and suffered a frightening experience. Red Army intelligence had expected him to continue to spy for them and asked him to infiltrate the U.S. military. When he said he would rather not, they became nasty and threatened to send him to a labor camp. He got out of it by saying he spoke no English, therefore he was no use to them. But Carla was well warned and decided it was safest to keep quiet. Today Carla and Maud were happy because they had sold a chest of drawers. It was a Jungenstil piece in burled light oak that Walter's parents had bought them when they got married in 1889. Carla, Maud, and Ada had loaded it onto a borrowed handcart. There were still no men in their house. Erich and Werner were among millions of German soldiers who had disappeared. Perhaps they were dead. Colonel Beck had told Carla that almost 3 million Germans had died in battle on the Eastern Front, and more had died as prisoners of the Soviets, killed by hunger, cold, and disease. But another 2 million were still alive and working in labor camps in the Soviet Union. Some had come back. They had either escaped from their guards or had been released because they were too ill to work, and they had joined the thousands of displaced persons on the tramp all over Europe, trying to find their way home. Carla and Maud had written letters and sent them care of the Red Army, but no replies had ever come. Carla felt torn about the prospect of Werner's return. She still loved him and hoped desperately that he was alive and well, but she dreaded meeting him when she was pregnant with a rapist's baby. Although it was not her fault, she felt irrationally ashamed. So the three women pushed the handcart through the streets. They left Rebecca behind. The Red Army orgy of rape and looting had passed its nightmare peak, and Rebecca no longer lived in the attic, but it was still not safe for a pretty girl to walk the streets. Huge photographs of Lenin and Stalin now hung over Unter den Linden, once the promenade of Germany's fashionable elite. Most Berlin roads had been cleared, and the rubble of destroyed buildings stood in stacks every few hundred yards, ready to be reused, perhaps, if ever Germans were able to rebuild their country. Acres of houses had been flattened, often entire city blocks. It would take years to deal with the wreckage. There were thousands of bodies rotting in the ruins, and the sickly sweet smell of decaying human flesh had been in the air all summer. Now it smelled only after rain. Meanwhile, the city had been divided into four zones: Russian, American, British, and French. Many of the buildings still standing had been commandeered by the occupying troops. Berliners lived where they could, often seeking inadequate shelter in the surviving rooms of half-demolished houses. The city had running water again, and electric power came on fitfully, but it was hard to find fuel for heating and cooking. The chest of drawers might be almost as valuable chopped up for firewood. They took it to Wedding, in the French zone, where they sold it to a charming Parisian colonel for a carton of gitane. The occupation currency had become worthless, because the Soviets printed too much of it, so everything was bought and sold for cigarettes. Now they were returning triumphant, Maud and Ada steering the empty cart, while Carla walked alongside. She ached all over from pushing the cart, but they were rich. A whole carton of cigarettes would go a long way. Night fell and the temperature dropped to freezing. Their route home took them briefly into the British sector. Carla sometimes wondered whether the British might help her mother if they knew the hardship she was suffering. On the other hand, Maud had been a German citizen for 26 years. Her brother, Earl Fitzherbert, was wealthy and influential, but he had refused to support her after her marriage to Walter von Ulrich, and he was a stubborn man. It was not likely he would change his attitude. They came across a small crowd, 30 or 40 ragged people, outside a house that had been taken over by the occupying power. Stopping to find out what they were staring at, the three women saw a party going on inside. Through the windows, they could observe brightly lit rooms, laughing men and women holding drinks, and waitresses moving through the throng with trays of food. Carla looked around her. The crowd was mostly women and children. There were not many men left in Berlin, or indeed in Germany, and they were all staring longingly at the windows, like rejected sinners outside the gates of paradise. It was a pathetic sight. "This is obscene," said Maud, and she marched up the path to the door of the house. A British sentry stood in her way and said, "Nein, nein," probably the only German he knew. Maud addressed him in the crisp, upper-class English she had spoken as a girl, I must see your commanding officer immediately.
Carla admired her mother's nerve and poise, as always. The sentry looked doubtfully at Maud's threadbare coat, but after a moment he tapped on the door. It opened, and a face looked out.
English lady wants the CO, said the sentry.
A moment later the door opened again, and two people looked out. They might have been caricatures of a British officer and his wife, he in his mess kit, with a black bow tie, she in a long dress and pearls.
Good evening, Maud said. I'm frightfully sorry to disturb your party.
They stared at her, astonished to be spoken to that way by a woman in rags. Maud went on.
I just thought you should see what you're doing to these wretched people outside.
The couple looked at the crowd.
Maud said, You might draw the curtains, for pity's sake.
After a moment, the woman said,
Oh dear, George, have we been terribly unkind?
Unintentionally, perhaps, the man said gruffly.
Could we possibly make amends by sending some food out to them?
Yes, Maud said quickly, that would be a kindness as well as an apology.
The officer looked dubious. It was probably against some kind of regulation to give canapes to starving Germans. The woman pleaded,
George, darling, may we?
Oh, very well, said her husband.
The woman turned back to Maud.
Thank you for alerting us. We really didn't mean to do this.
You're welcome, Maud said,
and she retreated down the path. A few minutes later, guests began to emerge from the house with plates of sandwiches and cakes, which they offered to the starving crowd. Carla grinned. Her mother's impudence had paid off. She took a large piece of fruitcake, which she wolfed in a few starved bites. It contained more sugar than she had eaten in the past 6 months. The curtains were drawn. The guests returned to the house, and the crowd dispersed. Maud and Ada grasped the handles of the cart and recommenced pushing it home.
Well done, mother, said Carla. A carton of gitan and a free meal, all in one afternoon.
Apart from the Soviets, few of the occupying soldiers were cruel to Germans, Carla reflected. She found it surprising. American GIs gave out chocolate bars. Even the French, whose own children had gone hungry under German occupation, often showed kindness. After all the misery we Germans have inflicted on our neighbors, Carla thought, it's astonishing they don't hate us more. On the other hand, what with the Nazis, the Red Army, and the air raids, perhaps they think we've been punished enough. It was late when they got home. They left the cart with the neighbors who had loaned it, giving them half a pack of gitan as payment. They entered the house, which was luckily still intact. There was no glass in most of the windows, and the stonework was pocked with craters, but the place had not suffered structural damage, and it still kept the weather out. All the same, the four women now lived in the kitchen, sleeping there on mattresses they dragged in from the hall at night. It was hard enough to warm that one room, and they certainly did not have fuel to heat the rest of the house. The kitchen stove had burned coal in the old days, but that was now virtually unobtainable. However, they had found the stove would burn many other things: books, newspapers, broken furniture, even net curtains. They slept in pairs, Carla with Rebecca, and Maud with Ada. Rebecca often cried herself to sleep in Carla's arms, as she had the night after her parents were killed. The long walk had exhausted Carla, and she immediately lay down. Ada built up the fire in the stove with old news magazines Rebecca had brought down from the attic. Maud added water to the remains of the lunchtime bean soup and reheated it for their supper. Sitting up to drink her soup, Carla suffered a sharp abdominal pain. This was not a result of pushing the handcart, she realized. It was something else. She checked the date and counted back to the date of the liberation of the Jewish hospital.
Mother, she said fearfully, I think the baby's coming.
It's too soon, Maud said.
I'm 36 weeks pregnant, and I'm getting cramps.
Then we'd better get ready.
Maud went upstairs to fetch towels. Ada brought a wooden chair from the dining room. She had a useful length of twisted steel from a bombsight that served her as a sledgehammer. She smashed the chair into manageable pieces, then built up the fire in the stove. Carla put her hands on her distended belly.
You might have waited for warmer weather, baby, she said.
Soon she was in too much pain to notice the cold. She had not known anything could hurt this much.
nor that it could go on so long. She was in labor all night. Maud and Ada took turns holding her hand while she moaned and cried. Rebecca looked on, white-faced and scared. The gray light of morning was filtering through the newspaper taped over the glassless kitchen window when at last the baby's head emerged. Carla was overwhelmed by a feeling of relief like nothing she had ever experienced, even though the pain did not immediately cease. After one more agonized push, Maud took the baby from between her legs. "A boy," she said. She blew on his face, and he opened his mouth and cried. She gave the baby to Carla and propped her upright on the mattress with some cushions from the drawing room. He had lots of dark hair all over his head. Maud tied off the cord with a piece of cotton, then cut it. Carla unbuttoned her blouse and put the baby to her breast. She was worried she might have no milk. Her breasts should have swollen and leaked toward the end of her pregnancy, but they had not, perhaps because the baby was early, perhaps because the mother was undernourished. But after a few moments of sucking, she felt a strange pain, and the milk began to flow. Soon he fell asleep. Ada brought a bowl of warm water and a rag, and gently washed the baby's face and head, then the rest of him. Rebecca whispered, "He's so beautiful." Carla said, "Mother, shall we call him Walter?" She had not intended to be dramatic, but Maud fell apart. Her face crumpled and she bent double, racked by terrible sobs. She recovered herself sufficiently to say, "I'm sorry." Then she was convulsed by grief again. "Oh, Walter, my Walter," she wept. Eventually her crying subsided. "I'm sorry," she said again. "I didn't mean to make a fuss." She wiped her face with her sleeve. "I just wish your father could see the baby, that's all. It's so unfair." Ada surprised them both by quoting the book of Job. "The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away," she said. "Blessed be the name of the Lord." Carla did not believe in God. No holy being worthy of the name could have allowed the Nazi death camps to happen, but all the same she found comfort in the quotation. It was about accepting everything in human life, including the pain of birth and the sorrow of death. Maud seemed to appreciate it too, and she became calmer. Carla looked adoringly at baby Walter. She would care for him and feed him and keep him warm, she vowed, no matter what difficulties stood in the way. He was the most wonderful child that had ever been born, and she would love and cherish him forever. He woke up, and Carla gave him her nipple again. He sucked contentedly, making small smacking noises with his mouth, while four women watched him. For a little while, in the warm, dim-lit kitchen, there was no other sound. 2. The first speech made by a new member of Parliament is called a maiden speech, and is usually dull. Certain things have to be said, stock phrases are used, and the convention is that the subject must not be controversial. Colleagues and opponents alike congratulate the newcomer, the traditions are observed, and the ice is broken. Lloyd Williams made his first real speech a few months later, during the debate on the National Insurance Bill. That was more scary. In preparing it, he had two orators in mind. His grandfather, Di Williams, used the language and rhythm of the Bible, not just in chapel, but also, perhaps especially, when speaking of the hardship and injustice of the life of a coal miner. He relished short words, rich in meaning. Toil, sin, greed. He spoke of the hearth and the pit and the grave. Churchill did the same, but had humor that Di Williams lacked. His long, majestic sentences often ended with an unexpected image or a reversal of meaning. Having been editor of the government newspaper, the British Gazette, during the general strike of 1926, he had warned trade unionists, "Make your minds perfectly clear. If ever you let loose upon us again a general strike, we will loose upon you another British Gazette." A speech needed such surprises, Lloyd believed. They were like the raisins in a bun. But when he stood up to speak, he found that his carefully wrought sentences suddenly seemed unreal. His audience clearly felt the same, and he could sense that the 50 or 60 MPs in the chamber were only half listening. He suffered a moment of panic. How could he be boring about a subject that mattered so profoundly to the people he represented? On the government front bench, he could see his mother, now Minister for Schools, and his uncle Billy, Minister for Coal. Billy Williams had started work down the pit at the age of 13, Lloyd knew. Ethel had been the same age when she began scrubbing the floors of Tiguin. This debate was not about fine phrases. It was about their lives. After a minute, he abandoned his script and spoke extempore. He recalled, instead, the misery of working-class families made penniless by unemployment or disability, scenes he had witnessed first-hand in the East End of London and the South Wales coalfield. His voice betrayed the emotion he felt, somewhat to his embarrassment, but he ploughed on. He sensed his audience beginning to pay attention. He spoke of his grandfather and others who had started the labour movement with the dream of comprehensive employment insurance to banish forever the fear of destitution. When he sat down, there was a roar of approval. In the visitors' gallery, his wife, Daisy, smiled proudly and gave him a thumbs-up sign. He listened to the rest of the debate in a glow of satisfaction. He felt he had passed his first real test as an MP. Afterward, in the lobby, he was approached by a Labour whip, one of the people responsible for making sure MPs voted the right way. After congratulating Lloyd on his speech, the whip said, "How would you like to be a parliamentary private secretary?" Lloyd was thrilled. Each minister and secretary of state had at least one PPS. In truth, a PPS was often little more than a bag carrier, but the job was the usual first step on the way to a ministerial appointment. "I'd be honoured," Lloyd said. "Who would I be working for?" "Ernie Bevin." Lloyd could hardly believe his luck. Bevin was Foreign Secretary and the closest colleague of Prime Minister Attlee. The intimate relationship between the two men was a case of the attraction of opposites. Attlee was middle class, the son of a lawyer, an Oxford graduate, an officer in the First World War. Bevin was the illegitimate child of a housemaid, never knew his father, started work at the age of 11, and founded the Mammoth Transport and General Workers Union. They were physical opposites, too. Attlee, slim and dapper, quiet, solemn. Bevin, a huge man, tall and strong and overweight, with a loud laugh. The Foreign Secretary referred to the Prime Minister as Little Clem. All the same, they were staunch allies. Bevin was a hero to Lloyd and to millions of ordinary British people. "There's nothing I'd like more," Lloyd said. "But hasn't Bevin already got a PPS?" "He needs two," the whip said. "Go to the Foreign Office tomorrow morning at 9 and you can get started."
"Thank you."
Lloyd hurried along the oak-panelled corridor, heading for his mother's office. He had arranged to meet Daisy there after the debate.
"Ma'am," he said as he entered, "I've been made PPS to Ernie Bevin."
Then he saw that Ethel was not alone. Earl Fitzherbert was with her. Fitz stared at Lloyd with a mixture of surprise and distaste. Even in his shock, Lloyd noticed that his father was wearing a perfectly cut light grey suit with a double-breasted waistcoat. He looked back at his mother. She was quite calm. This encounter was not a surprise to her. She must have contrived it. The Earl came to the same conclusion.
"What the devil is this, Ethel?"
Lloyd stared at the man whose blood ran in his veins. Even in this embarrassing situation, Fitz was poised and dignified. He was handsome, despite the drooping eyelid that resulted from the Battle of the Somme. He leaned on a walking stick, another consequence of the Somme. A few months short of 60 years old, he was immaculately groomed, his grey hair neatly trimmed, his silver tie tightly knotted, his black shoes shining. Lloyd, too, always liked to look well turned out.
"That's where I get it from," he thought.
Ethel went and stood close to the Earl. Lloyd knew his mother well enough to understand this move. She frequently used her charm when she wanted to persuade a man. All the same, Lloyd did not like to see her being so warm to one who had exploited her, then let her down.
"I was so sorry when I heard about the death of Boy," she said to Fitz. "Nothing is as precious to us as our children, is it?"
"I must go," Fitz said. Until this moment, Lloyd had met Fitz only in passing. He had never before spent this much time with him or heard him speak this number of words. Despite feeling uncomfortable, Lloyd was fascinated. Grumpy though he was right now, Fitz had a kind of allure.
"Please, Fitz," said Ethel, "you have a son whom you have never acknowledged, a son you should be proud of."
"You shouldn't do this, Ethel," said Fitz. "A man is entitled to forget the mistakes of his youth." Lloyd cringed with embarrassment, but his mother pressed on.
"Why should you want to forget? I know he was a mistake, but look at him now. A member of Parliament who has just made a thrilling speech and been appointed PPS to the Foreign Secretary."
Fitz pointedly did not look at Lloyd. Ethel said, "You want to pretend that our affair was a meaningless dalliance, but you know the truth."
"Yes, we were young and foolish, and randy too. Me as much as you.
But we loved each other.
We really loved each other, Fitz.
You should admit it. Don't you know that if you deny the truth about yourself, you lose your soul?" Fitz's face was no longer merely impassive, Lloyd saw. He was struggling to maintain control. Lloyd understood that his mother had put her finger on the real problem. It was not so much that Fitz was ashamed of having an illegitimate son, but he was too proud to accept that he had loved a housemaid. He probably loved Ethel more than his wife, Lloyd guessed, and that upset all his most fundamental beliefs about the social hierarchy. Lloyd spoke for the first time. "I was with Boy at the end, sir. He died bravely." For the first time, Fitz looked at him. "My son doesn't require your approval," he said. Lloyd felt as if he had been slapped. Even Ethel was shocked.
"Fitz," she said, "how can you be so mean?"
At that point, Daisy came in. "Hello, Fitz," she said gaily. "You probably thought you'd got rid of me, but now you're my father-in-law again.
Isn't that amusing?"
Ethel said, "I'm just trying to persuade Fitz to shake Lloyd's hand." Fitz said, "I try to avoid shaking hands with socialists." Ethel was fighting a losing battle, but she would not give up.
"See how much of yourself there is in him. He resembles you, dresses like you, shares your interest in politics. He'll probably end up Foreign Secretary, which you always wanted to be."
Fitz's expression darkened further. "It is now most unlikely that I shall ever be Foreign Secretary." He went to the door. "And it would not please me in the least if that great office of state were to be held by my Bolshevik bastard." With that, he walked out. Ethel burst into tears. Daisy put her arm around Lloyd.
"I'm so sorry," she said.
"Don't worry," Lloyd said. "I'm not shocked or disappointed."
This was not true, but he did not want to appear pathetic. "I was rejected by him a long time ago." He looked at Daisy with adoration.
"I'm lucky to have plenty of other people who love me."
Ethel said tearfully,
"It's my fault. I shouldn't have asked him to come here. I might have known it would turn out badly."
"Never mind," said Daisy. "I have some good news."
Lloyd smiled at her.
"What's that?"
She looked at Ethel.
"Are you ready for this?"
"I think so."
"Come on," said Lloyd.
"What is it?"
Daisy said,
"We're going to have a baby."
3. Carla's brother, Eric, came home that summer, near to death. He had contracted tuberculosis in a Soviet labor camp, and they had released him when he became too ill to work. He had been sleeping rough for weeks, traveling on freight trains and begging lifts on lorries. He arrived at the von Ulrich house barefoot and wearing filthy clothes. His face was like a skull. However, he did not die. It might have been being with people who loved him, or the warmer weather as winter turned into spring, or perhaps just rest. But he coughed less and regained enough energy to do some work around the house, boarding up smashed windows, repairing roof tiles, unblocking pipes. Fortunately, at the beginning of the year, Frieda Frank had struck gold. Ludwig Frank had been killed in the air raid that destroyed his factory, and for a while, Frieda and her mother had been as destitute as everyone else. But she got a job as a nurse in the American zone, and soon afterward, she explained to Carla, a little group of American doctors had asked her to sell their surplus food and cigarettes on the black market in exchange for a cut of the proceeds. Thereafter, she turned up at Carla's house once a week with a little basket of supplies. Warm clothing, candles, flashlight batteries, matches, soap, and food. Bacon, chocolate, apples, rice, canned peaches. Maud divided the food into portions and gave Carla double. Carla accepted, without hesitation, not for her own sake, but to help her feed baby Vali. Without Frida's illicit groceries, Vali might not have made it. He was changing fast. The dark hair with which he had been born had now gone, and instead he had fine, fair hair. At 6 months he had Maud's wonderful green eyes. As his face took shape, Carla noticed a fold of flesh in the outer corners of his eyes that gave him a slant-eyed look, and she wondered if his father had been a Siberian. She could not remember all the men who had raped her. Most of the time she had closed her eyes. She no longer hated them. It was strange, but she was so happy to have Vali that she could hardly bring herself to regret what had happened. Rebecca was fascinated by Vali. Now just 15, she was old enough to have the beginnings of maternal feelings, and she eagerly helped Carla bathe and dress the baby. She played with him constantly, and he gurgled with delight when he saw her. As soon as Eric felt well enough, he joined the Communist Party. Carla was baffled. After what he had suffered at the hands of the Soviets, how could he? But she found that he talked about communism in the same way he had talked about Nazism a decade earlier. She just hoped that this time his disillusionment would not be so long coming. The Allies were keen for democracy to return to Germany, and city elections were scheduled for Berlin later in 1946. Carla felt sure the city would not return to normal until its own people took control, so she decided to stand for the Social Democratic Party. But Berliners quickly discovered that the Soviet occupiers had a curious notion of what democracy meant. The Soviets had been shocked by the results of elections in Austria last November. The Austrian communists had expected to run neck and neck with the socialists, but had won only 4 seats out of 165. It seemed that voters blamed communism for the brutality of the Red Army. The Kremlin, unused to genuine elections, had not anticipated that. To avoid a similar result in Germany, the Soviets proposed a merger between the communists and the Social Democrats in what they called a united front. The Social Democrats refused, despite heavy pressure. In East Germany, the Russians started arresting Social Democrats, just as the Nazis had in 1933. There, the merger was forced through, but the Berlin elections were supervised by the 4 Allies, and the Social Democrats survived. Once the weather warmed up, Carla was able to take her turn queuing for food. She carried Vali with her wrapped in a pillowcase. She had no baby clothes. Standing in line for potatoes one morning, a few blocks from home, she was surprised to see an American Jeep pull up with Frida in the passenger seat. The balding, middle-aged driver kissed her on the lips, and she jumped out. She was wearing a sleeveless blue dress and new shoes. She walked quickly away, heading for the von Ulrich house, carrying her little basket. Carla saw everything in a flash. Frida was not trading on the black market, and there was no syndicate of doctors. She was the paid mistress of an American officer. It was not unusual. Thousands of pretty German girls had been faced with the choice: see your family starve, or sleep with a generous officer. French women had done the same under German occupation. Officers' wives back here in Germany had spoken bitterly about it. All the same, Carla was horrified. She believed that Frida loved Heinrich. They were planning to get married as soon as life returned to some semblance of normality. Carla felt sick at heart. She reached the head of the line and bought her ration of potatoes, then hurried home. She found Frida upstairs in the drawing room. Eric had cleaned up the room and put newspaper in the windows, the next best thing to glass. The curtains had long ago been recycled as bed linen, but most of the chairs had survived so far, their upholstery faded and worn. The grand piano was still there, miraculously. A Russian officer had discovered it and announced that he would return next day with a crane to lift it out through the window, but he had never come back. Frida immediately took Vali from Carla and began to sing to him. ABC, die Katze lief im Schnee. The women who had not yet had children, Rebecca and Frida, could hardly get enough of Vali, Carla observed. Those who had had children of their own, Maud and Ada, adored him but dealt with him in a briskly practical way. Frida opened the lid of the piano and encouraged Vali to bang on the keys as she sang. The instrument had not been played for years. Maud had not touched it since the death of her last pupil, Joachim Koch. After a few minutes, Frieda said to Carla,
"You're a bit solemn. What is it?"
"I know how you get the food you bring us," Carla said. "You're not a black marketeer, are you?"
"Of course I am,"
Frieda said.
"What are you talking about?"
"I saw you this morning, getting out of a jeep. Colonel Hicks gave me a lift. He kissed you on the lips." Frieda looked away.
"I knew I should have got out earlier. I could have walked from the American zone. Frieda, what about Heinrich? He'll never know. I'll be more careful, I swear."
"Do you still love him?"
"Of course. We're going to get married."
"Then why?"
"I've had enough of hard times. I want to put on pretty clothes and go to nightclubs and dance."
"No, you don't," Carla said confidently. "You can't lie to me, Frieda. We've been friends too long. Tell me the truth."
"The truth?"
"Yes, please."
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure.
I did it for Vali."
Carla gasped with shock. That had never occurred to her, but it made sense. She could believe Frieda would make such a sacrifice for her and her baby. But she felt dreadful. This made her responsible for Frieda's prostituting herself.
"This is terrible,"
Carla said.
"You shouldn't have done it. We would have managed somehow."
Frieda sprang up from the piano stool with the baby still in her arms.
"No, you wouldn't,"
she blazed. Vali was frightened and cried. Carla took him and rocked him, patting his back.
"You wouldn't have managed,"
Frieda said more quietly.
"How do you know?" "All last winter, babies were brought into the hospital naked, wrapped in newspapers, dead of hunger and cold. I could hardly bear to look at them."
"Oh, God." Carla held Vali tight. "They turn a peculiar bluish color when they freeze to death."
"Stop it.
I have to tell you, otherwise you won't understand what I did. Vali would have been one of those blue, frozen babies."
"I know,"
Carla whispered.
"I know. Percy Hicks is a kind man. He has a frumpy wife back in Boston, and I'm the sexiest thing he's ever seen. He's nice and quick about intercourse and always uses a condom."
"You should stop," Carla said.
"You don't mean that."
"No,
I don't,"
Carla confessed.
"And that's the worst part. I feel so guilty. I am guilty."
"You're not. It's my choice. German women have to make hard choices. We're paying for the easy choices German men made 15 years ago. Men such as my father, who thought Hitler would be good for business, and Heinrich's father, who voted for the Enabling Act. The sins of the fathers are visited on the daughters."
There was a loud knock at the front door. A moment later they heard scampering steps as Rebecca hurried upstairs to hide, just in case it was the Red Army. Then Ada's voice said,
"Oh, sir, good morning."
She sounded surprised and a bit worried, though not scared. Carla wondered who would induce that particular mixture of reactions in the maid. There was a heavy masculine tread on the stairs. Then Werner walked in. He was dirty and ragged, and thin as a rail, but there was a broad smile on his handsome face.
"It's me," he said ebulliently. "I'm back."
Then he saw the baby. His jaw dropped, and the happy smile disappeared.
"Oh,"
he said.
"What? Who? Whose baby is that?"
"Mine, my darling," said Carla. "Let me explain."
"Explain?"
he said angrily. "What explanation is necessary? You've had someone else's baby." He turned to go. Frieda said, "Werner, in this room are two women who love you. Don't walk out without listening to us. You don't understand."
"I think I understand everything."
"Carla was raped." He went pale.
"Raped? Who by?"
Carla said, "I never knew their names."
"Names?"
Werner swallowed.
There was more than one?"
5 Red Army soldiers." His voice fell to a whisper.
5?
Carla nodded.
"But couldn't you? I mean..."
Frieda said, "I was raped too, Werner, and so was Mother."
"Dear God, what has been going on here?"
"Hell," said Frieda. Werner sat down heavily in a worn leather chair. "I thought hell was where I've been," he said. He buried his face in his hands. Carla crossed the room, still holding Vali, and stood in front of Werner's chair. Look at me, Werner, she said.
Please.
He looked up, his face twisted with emotion.
Hell is over, she said.
Is it?
Yes,
she said firmly. Life is hard, but the Nazis have gone. The war is finished. Hitler is dead, and the Red Army rapists have been brought under control, more or less. The nightmare has ended, and we're both alive and together.
He reached out and took her hand.
You're right.
We've got Vali, and in a minute you'll meet a 15-year-old girl called Rebecca, who has somehow become my child. We have to make a new family out of what the war has left us, just as we have to build new houses with the rubble in the streets.
He nodded acceptance.
I need your love, she said. So do Rebecca and Vali.
He stood up slowly. She looked at him expectantly. He said nothing, but after a long moment, he put his arms around her and the baby, gently embracing them both.
4. Under wartime regulations still in force, the British government had a right to open a coal mine anywhere, regardless of the wishes of the owner of the land. Compensation was paid only for loss of earnings on farmland or commercial property. Billy Williams, as Minister for Coal, authorized an open cast mine on the grounds of Tyguin, the palatial residence of Earl Fitzherbert on the outskirts of Aberowen. No compensation was payable as the land was not commercial. There was uproar on the Conservative benches in the House of Commons.
Your slag heap will be right under the bedroom windows of the Countess, said one indignant Tory.
Billy Williams smiled. The Earl's slag heap has been under my mother's window for 50 years, he said. Lloyd Williams and Ethel both travelled to Aberowen with Billy the day before the engineers began to dig the hole. Lloyd was reluctant to leave Daisy, who was due to give birth in 2 weeks, but it was a historic moment, and he wanted to be there. Both his grandparents were now in their late 70s. Grandad was almost blind, despite his pebble-lensed glasses, and Grandmam was bent-backed.
This is nice, Grandmam said when they all sat around the old kitchen table. Both my children here.
She served stewed beef with mashed turnips and thick slices of homemade bread spread with the butcher's fat called dripping. She poured large mugs of sweetened milky tea to go with it. Lloyd had eaten like this frequently as a child, but now he found it coarse. He knew that, even in hard times, French and Spanish women managed to serve up tasty dishes delicately flavored with garlic and garnished with herbs. He was ashamed of his fastidiousness, and pretended to eat and drink with relish.
"Pity about the gardens at Tyguin,"
Grandmam said tactlessly. Billy was stung.
"What do you mean? Britain needs the coal." "But people love those gardens. Beautiful they are. I've been there at least once every year since I was a girl. Shame it is to see them go."
"There's a perfectly good recreation ground right in the middle of Aberowen."
"It's not the same," said Grandmam imperturbably.
Granda said, "Women will never understand politics."
"No," said Grandmam, "I don't suppose we will."
Lloyd caught his mother's eye. She smiled and said nothing. Billy and Lloyd shared the second bedroom, and Ethel made up a bed on the kitchen floor.
"I slept in this room every night of my life until I went in the army,"
Billy said as they lay down, "and I looked out the window every morning at that fucking slag heap."
"Keep your voice down, Uncle Billy," Lloyd said. "You don't want your mother to hear you swear."
"Eh, you're right," said Billy.
Next morning after breakfast, they all walked up the hill to the big house. It was a mild morning, and for a change there was no rain. The ridge of mountains at the skyline was softened with summer grass. As Tyguin came into view, Lloyd could not help seeing it more as a beautiful building than as a symbol of oppression. It was both, of course. Nothing was simple in politics. The great iron gates stood open. The Williams family passed onto the grounds. A crowd had gathered already. The contractor's men with their machinery, 100 or so miners and their families, Earl Fitzherbert with his son Andrew, a handful of reporters with notebooks, and a film crew. The gardens were breathtaking. The avenue of ancient chestnut trees was in full leaf. There were swans on the lake, and the flower beds blazed with color. Lloyd guessed the Earl had made sure the place looked its best. He wanted to brand the Labour government as wreckers in the eyes of the world. Lloyd found himself sympathizing with Fitz. The Mayor of Aberowen was giving an interview. "The people of this town are against the open cast mine," he said. Lloyd was surprised. The town council was Labour, and it must have gone against the grain for them to oppose the government. For more than 100 years, the beauty of these gardens has refreshed the souls of people who live in a grim industrial landscape, the mayor went on. Switching from prepared speech to personal reminiscence, he added, "I proposed to my wife under that cedar tree." He was interrupted by a loud clanking sound, like the footsteps of an iron giant. Turning to look back along the drive, Lloyd saw a huge machine approaching. It looked like the biggest crane in the world. It had an enormous boom, 90 feet long, and a bucket into which a lorry could easily fit. Most astonishing of all, it moved along on rotating steel shoes that made the earth shake every time they hit the ground. Billy said proudly to Lloyd, "That's a walking Monaghan dragline excavator. Picks up 6 tons of earth at a time." The film camera rolled as the monstrous machine stomped up the drive. Lloyd had only one misgiving about the Labour Party. There was a streak of Puritan authoritarianism in many socialists. His grandfather had it, and so did Billy. They were not comfortable with sensual pleasures. Sacrifice and self-denial suited them better. They dismissed the ravishing beauty of these gardens as irrelevant. They were wrong. Ethel was not that way, nor was Lloyd. Perhaps the killjoy strain had been bred out of their line. He hoped so. Fitz gave an interview on the pink gravel path while the digger driver maneuvered his machine into position. "The Minister for Coal has told you that when the mine is exhausted, the garden will be subject to what he calls an effective restoration program," he said. "I say to you that that promise is worthless. It has taken more than a century for my grandfather and my father and I to bring the garden to its present pitch of beauty and harmony. It would take another 100 years to restore it." The boom of the excavator was lowered until it stood at a 45-degree angle over the shrubbery and flower beds of the west garden. The bucket was positioned over the croquet lawn. There was a long moment of waiting. The crowd fell silent. Billy said loudly, "Get on with it, for God's sake!" An engineer in a bowler hat blew a whistle. The bucket was dropped to the earth with a massive thud. Its steel teeth dug into the flat green lawn. The drag rope tautened. There was a loud creak of straining machinery. Then the bucket began to move back. As it was dragged across the ground, it dug up a bed of huge yellow sunflowers, the rose garden, a shrubbery of summer sweet and bottle brush buckeye, and a small magnolia tree. At the end of its travel, the bucket was full of earth, flowers, and plants. The bucket was then lifted to a height of 20 feet, dribbling loose earth and blossoms. The boom swung sideways. It was taller than the house, Lloyd saw. He almost thought the bucket would smash the upstairs windows, but the operator was skilled and stopped it just in time. The drag rope slackened, the bucket tilted, and 6 tons of garden fell to the ground a few feet from the entrance. The bucket was returned to its original position, and the process was repeated. Lloyd looked at Fitz and saw that he was crying. Chapter 23. 1947. At the beginning of 1947, it seemed possible that all Europe might go communist. Volodya Peshkov was not sure whether to hope for that or its opposite. The Red Army dominated Eastern Europe, and communists were winning elections in the West. Communists had gained respect for their role in resisting the Nazis. 5 million people had voted communist in the first French post-war election, making the communists the most popular party. In Italy, a communist-socialist alliance won 40% of the vote. In Czechoslovakia, the communists on their own won 38% and led the democratically elected government. It was different in Austria and Germany, where voters had been robbed and raped by the Red Army. In the Berlin city elections, the Social Democrats won 63 of 130 seats, the Communists only 26. However, Germany was ruined and starving, and the Kremlin still hoped that the people might turn to communism in desperation, just as they had turned to Nazism in the Depression. Britain was the great disappointment. Only one communist had been sent to Parliament in the post-war election there, and the Labour government was delivering everything communism promised. Welfare, free healthcare, education for all, even a 5-day week for coal miners. But in the rest of Europe, capitalism was failing to lift people out of the post-war slump. And the weather was on Stalin's side, Volodya thought, as the layers of snow grew thick on the onion domes. The winter of 1946 to 1947 was the coldest in Europe for more than a century. Snow fell in Saint-Tropez. British roads and railways became impassable, and industry ground to a halt, something that had never happened in the war. In France, food rations fell below wartime levels. The United Nations organization calculated that 100 million Europeans were living on 1,500 calories a day, the level at which health begins to suffer from malnutrition. As the engines of production ran slower and slower, people began to feel they had nothing to lose, and revolution came to seem the only way out. Once the USSR had nuclear weapons, no other country would be able to stand in its way. Volodya's wife, Zoya, and her colleagues had built a nuclear pile at Laboratory No. 2 of the Academy of Sciences, a deliberately vague name for the powerhouse of Soviet nuclear research. The pile had gone critical on Christmas Day, 6 months after the birth of their son, Konstantin, who was at the time sleeping in the laboratory's creche. If the experiment went wrong, Zoya had whispered to Volodya, it would do little Kotya no good to be a mile or two away. All central Moscow would be flattened. Volodya's conflicting feelings about the future took on a new intensity with the birth of his son. He wanted Kotya to grow up a citizen of a proud and powerful country. The Soviet Union deserved to dominate Europe, he felt. It was the Red Army that had defeated the Nazis in 4 cruel years of total warfare. The other Allies had stood on the sidelines, fighting minor wars, joining in only for the last 11 months. All their casualties put together were only a fraction of those suffered by the Soviet people. But then he would think of what communism meant: arbitrary purges, torture in the basements of the secret police, conquering soldiers urged on to excesses of bestiality, the whole vast country forced to obey the wayward decisions of a tyrant more powerful than a tsar. Did Volodya really want to extend that brutal system to the rest of the continent? He remembered walking into Penn Station in New York and buying a ticket to Albuquerque, without asking anyone's permission or showing any papers, and the exhilarating sense of total freedom that had given him. He had long ago burned the Sears Roebuck catalogue, but it lived in his memory, with its hundreds of pages of good things available for everyone to have. Russian people believed that stories of Western freedom and prosperity were just propaganda, but Volodya knew better. A part of him longed for communism to be defeated. The future of Germany, and therefore of Europe, was to be decided at the Conference of Foreign Ministers held in Moscow in March 1947. Volodya, now a colonel, was in charge of the intelligence team assigned to the conference. Meetings were held in an ornate room at Aviation Industry House, conveniently close to the Hotel Moskva. As always, the delegates and their interpreters sat around a table, with their aides on several rows of chairs behind them. The Soviet foreign minister, Vyacheslav Molotov, old Stonehouse, demanded that Germany pay $10 billion to the USSR in war reparations. The Americans and British protested that this would be a death blow to Germany's sickly economy. That was probably what Stalin wanted. Volodya renewed his acquaintance with Woody Duer, who was now a news photographer assigned to cover the conference. He was married, too, and showed Volodya a photo of a striking, dark-haired woman holding a baby. Sitting in the back of a ZIS 110B limousine, returning from a formal photo session at the Kremlin, Woody said to Volodya, "You realize that Germany doesn't have the money to pay your reparations, don't you?" Volodya's English had improved, and they could manage without an interpreter. He said, "Then how are they feeding their people and rebuilding their cities?" "With handouts from us, of course," said Woody. "We're spending a fortune in aid. Any reparations the Germans paid you would be, in reality, our money." "Is that so wrong?"
The United States prospered in the war. My country was devastated. Maybe you should pay.
American voters don't think so. American voters may be wrong. Woody shrugged.
True, but it's their money.
There it was again, Volodya thought, the deference to public opinion. He had remarked it before in Woody's conversation. Americans talked about voters the way Russians talked about Stalin. They had to be obeyed, right or wrong. Woody wound down the window. You don't mind if I take a cityscape, do you? The light is wonderful. His camera clicked. He knew he was supposed to take only approved shots. However, there was nothing sensitive on the street, just some women shoveling snow. All the same, Volodya said, please don't. He leaned past Woody and wound up the window. Official photos only. He was about to ask for the film out of Woody's camera when Woody said, do you remember me mentioning my friend Greg Peshkov, with the same surname as you? Volodya certainly did. Vili Frunze had said something similar. It was probably the same man.
No, I don't remember, Volodya lied.
He wanted nothing to do with a possible relative in the West. Such connections brought suspicion and trouble to Russians. He's on the American delegation. You should talk to him. See if you're related.
I will, said Volodya,
resolving to avoid the man at all costs. He decided not to insist on taking Woody's film. It was not worth the fuss for a harmless street scene. At the next day's conference, the American Secretary of State, George Marshall, proposed that the four allies should abolish the separate sectors of Germany and unify the country, so that it could once again become the beating economic heart of Europe, mining and manufacturing, and buying and selling. That was the last thing the Soviets wanted. Molotov refused to discuss unification until the question of reparations had been settled. The conference was stalemated. And that, Volodya thought, was exactly where Stalin wanted it. 2. The world of international diplomacy was a small one, Greg Peshkov reflected. One of the young aides in the British delegation at the Moscow conference was Lloyd Williams, the husband of Greg's half-sister Daisy. At first, Greg did not like the look of Lloyd, who was dressed like a prissy English gentleman, but he turned out to be a regular guy. Molotov is a prick, Lloyd said in the bar of the Hotel Moskva over a couple of vodka martinis. So what are we going to do about him? I don't know. But Britain can't live with these delays. The occupation of Germany is costing money we can't afford, and the hard winter has turned the problem into a crisis. You know what? Said Greg, thinking aloud. If the Soviets won't play ball, we should just go ahead without them. How could we do that? What do we want? Greg counted points on his fingers. We want to unify Germany and hold elections. So do we. We want to scrap the worthless Reichsmark and introduce a new currency so that Germans can start to do business again. Yes. And we want to save the country from communism. Also British policy. We can't do it in the East because the Soviets won't come to the party. So fuck them. We control 3/4 of Germany. Let's do it in our zone and let the eastern part of the country go to blazes. Lloyd looked thoughtful. Is this something you've discussed with your boss? Hell no. I'm just running off at the mouth. But listen, why not? I might suggest it to Ernie Bevin, and I'll put it to George Marshall. Greg sipped his drink. Vodka is the only thing the Russians do well, he said. So, how's my sister? She's expecting our second baby. What is Daisy like as a mother? Lloyd laughed. You think she's probably terrible. Greg shrugged. I never saw her as the domestic type. She's patient, calm, and organized. She didn't hire 6 nurses to do all the work. Just 1, so that she can come out with me in the evenings, usually to political meetings. Wow, she's changed. Not completely. She still loves parties. What about you? Still single? There's a girl called Nellie Fordham that I'm pretty serious about. And I guess you know that I have a godson. Yes, said Lloyd. Daisy told me all about him. Georgie. Greg felt sure, from the slightly embarrassed look on Lloyd's face, that he knew Georgie was Greg's child. I'm very fond of him. That's great.
A member of the Russian delegation came up to the bar, and Greg caught his eye. There was something very familiar about him. He was in his 30s, handsome apart from a brutally short military.